And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial, and the rest of the world live streaming at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're excited to have Sarah Flounders with us today. Sarah is co-director of the International Action Center and one of the leading anti-war activists in North America. Sarah, thank you very much for being here today.
Hello, good to be here talking.
Yes, I wanted to get you specifically because I know people in Canada are following your work, your writings for Global Research and other publications, and trying to see what we can learn from U.S. activists. And I guess the big story for us here in Hamilton is the big series of anti-war demonstrations that occurred on February 4th. We had heard about those through the grapevine. We had received some of the promos and ads, and people were asking me and members of the Anti-War Coalition Executive, are we doing something for February 4th? And of course, we have our own series of actions that we're going through, but certainly February 4th stood out. I guess it must have been a pretty big success. How many cities participated?
Well, I think we had a listing of 80 cities. It was interesting. Every time we posted a list, we would hear back from more people saying, you didn't include such and such a place. And that was always exciting. So it was 80 before the demonstration. We heard from a few more places afterwards saying that they had also had events on that day. So it was a tremendous, I will say, a response far beyond what we expected when we first called for it. It was just 2 weeks' notice, maybe 16, something like that, very, very short notice. And we were hoping that we could, you know, that there might be a response from 10 to 15 cities. So the fact that so many people right away signed on and said, yes, we'll do something, we'll do a local activity, that was both heartening, but it also showed how seriously what the sense of apprehension is in the population. Now also, to give an accurate evaluation, I think it's important to say none of these actions were in the thousands. This is not, you know, the lead up to and just before the Iraq War. This is the early stages, and it was the political movement that came out. I think in New York there was 500 plus, you know, 500 to 700 people who turned out. And across the country, it was numbers like that, in the hundreds, in city after city, but not in the tens of thousands, not in the millions. To have a realistic, I'm not saying that to in any way undercut it, but just so we have a real view of this was the anti-war activists, many organizations working together, and also feeling the need to begin to rally their forces.
Yes, perhaps we can understand this as a regrouping, because I know that there has been discussion in the United States and Canada that the anti-war movement had become weakened over the last few years, perhaps partly in association with Obama's electoral victory and the assumption that there would be significant change about the various wars that the U.S. has been engaged in. But without that change, with now the intervention in Libya, the continuing presence in Afghanistan and Iraq, I guess some people are coming back together and starting things up again. It's perhaps a reawakening. You mentioned that it was political organizers that were involved. So, again, it's a matter of getting things back together on the anti-war front?
Yes, very much so. I think also each U.S. war has attached to it such a process of demonization to push back those who would respond right away. We certainly saw that around Libya just in the recent past, but it's been true in every war that the number, the scale of attacks on Gaddafi, on the Libyan government, to justify this massive, really this bombing that was laid ruin to every city in Libya, for which nothing could be justified. In no way was it at a no-fly zone. It was really a no drive, no breathing. Anyone on the ground, huge use of drones to scale and count everyone's movement. So But that war did not have a huge number of people protesting. There was a great deal of silence. I know at the time we organized all across the country large meetings with Cynthia McKinney, who had just returned from Libya at the time. But there was not people in the streets in significant numbers. Now, what's happening now with Iran, what's going on right now with Syria, I think this has alarmed people that quite a large-scale war that would upend, which would destabilize a great deal, seems to be on the U.S. planning boards. And when they have one political leader after another coming out, sort of the whole Washington establishment to talk on Meet the Press and on all these programs on specials day after day about Iran and also on Syria, we have to take that very seriously. We have to know that behind all those talking heads are a lot of military movements.
Yes, there's been a very long, lingering debate over Iran in the media, in the policy establishment, because there are people within the United States in the government that do fear the consequences of an attack on Iran. But at the same time, there's always been groups pushing for that war. I think one of the things that proponents of the war are trying to do is just normalize the idea, make it a fait accompli, something that we just have to adjust to. So they know people don't want to go into Iran, but they're trying to pave the way with as much demonization and supposed incidents about Iran so that it can be easy to go ahead with a war should a war occur. Certainly, there's a lot of warmongering and some familiar faces and types of people. Ann Coulter is back. Romney's foreign policy team is big on the issue. I think Glenn Greenwald was talking about Diane Sawyer and Brian Ross popping up on CNN and places like that.
Yes, this is exactly true. All of this is calculated to make war with Iran seem acceptable and inevitable, that there's really very little the U.S. could do, that Israel is just going to take action, and all kinds of totally fraudulent arguments like this. It's important to say right from the jump that there is no action that Israel could take that would not have full U.S. approval, acknowledgement, and equipping. Israel couldn't even fly its, wouldn't even have authorization, wouldn't even be able to fly its planes on a bombing mission, be able to send missiles without that. And of course, Israel couldn't live one day without the billions of dollars that have gone for more than 60 years in economic and in military aid. And that's how Israel today has nuclear weapons, while supposedly the issue is Iran having nuclear weapons.
It's always been a fairy tale, the idea that Israel's just going to go off on its own and do something. Of course, as if it could do that without all the planning and mediation support of the United States. We remember how the U.S. resupplied Israel during its fight with Lebanon in 2006, the bombing there, and then
exactly.
Operation
yes.
Cast Lead. Israel depends on the United States for these kinds of operations.
Right, right. It really doesn't even have, even an operation like, that's such a good example, the attack on Lebanon, they needed a U.S. resupply of missiles right in the middle of it in order to continue.
Yeah, no, I think we have a good understanding by now of how these things work, and certainly the campaign against Iran is very much deja vu. I mean, it's kind of insulting. They can't even come up with a new story. It's weapons of mass destruction once again, and the sanctions issue, too, this is something that really confuses me because I remember the legal debate about the Iraq sanctions. And now, of course, there's sanctions on Iran. There have been for a while. And the basis by which these sanctions take place and their legitimacy and legality is very open to question. Just a month ago, our local newspaper here, the Hamilton Spectator, it published an article saying that the goal of Iran sanctions was regime collapse. That was close to the headline of the article, and it was from the Newswire, it quoted a senior U.S. intelligence figure who said that he hoped the sanctions would create enough hate and discontent at the street level that Iranians would turn against their government. Now, that's a pretty extraordinary statement, and it's been revised since that point. So if you go to the Washington Post, they've updated their version of the article to say that, no, that's not quite what the intelligence official said. And what he said was that they wanted to create hate and discontent at the street level so that the Iranian leaders realize they need to change their ways. Now, you know, whether or not he said regime change, they're basically admitting here, yeah, they're trying to punish ordinary Iranians, create hate and discontent to put pressure on the government. Is that even legal? Is this being done for the IAEA or the UN? I mean, who allows this?
Well, first of all, under any measure of international law, any withholding of food, medical supplies, or infrastructure to civilian populations is completely prohibited. The U.S. is signatory to this. It's true in the Geneva Conventions, Hague. This has been agreed to for, you know, decades in terms of international law. Sanctions are a direct violation of that. They target the civilian population with enormous shortages, with laying havoc to the economy, with stopping also food and basic necessities of life from coming in. What was done to Iraq, there's no greater war crime. And the famous quote from Madeleine Albright that the death of 500,000 children was worth it, I think we could never recover from that, because it means that they understand exactly what they're doing, and they consider in their calculations the death of millions of civilians worth it. So it's a violation of international law, yes. Are they planning to use it again? Yes. And will they get a UN condemnation? No. No, they won't. And that shows so much about how the UN is orchestrated today and controlled, and its resolutions publicized. When there's a General Assembly resolution, such as there's been annually for decades on Cuba, you'll never see an article against the Cuba blockade. You'll never see an article on it in the U.S. press. But if there's a resolution on Syria, of course, that's front page news. So there's this not only double standard, but abuse of what the UN is, what it stands for, what international law stands for, and complete lawlessness on an international scale where a country can be targeted on totally bogus charges, and then the entire population made war on.
Well, I should emphasize that. I mean, the purpose of the United Nations is to stop, prevent, and reduce conflicts between nations, between states. And you have these sanctions here. The United States, I think you've pointed this out in the past, the United States has told all the other countries in the world that they have to get in line with the sanctions on Iran, or they themselves will be sanctioned.
Now, that's exactly. These new sanctions passed with the National Defense Authorization, the NDAA, demand that every country stop all of its trade with Iran, or they can't do any kind of trade, banking, whatnot, with the U.S. Now, as the largest economy in the world, that really is demanding that every country participate in a blockade.
Yes,
of another country, and do so in ways that are damaging to their own economy, because the price of oil escalating. There's no way that Saudi heavy oil, much higher in sulfur content and so on, can make up for taking Iranian oil off the market. For the poorest countries, this is a devastating blow to their economy.
Yes.
And to that means for peasants, for poor paid workers, the cost of everything from home heating oil to cooking fuel to transportation costs escalate. In order to impose sanctions on Iran, great hardship for many countries in the world, and a demand that everyone participate in this.
Mm-hmm. It's like a medieval siege, but the reason I want to point this out specifically is because this is an act of war. You know,
yes.
There's been some discussion that there's a low-level war going on between U.S., Israel, against Iran. And there's been these actions and acts of sabotage. People know about the bombings and the explosions and the drones and so on. But saying that we're gonna make your population suffer and starve and we're going to force everyone in the world to go along with it, it's an act of war. Because if Iran did that, if Iran was in that position and said to the United States, we're going to prevent everyone from trading with you and make the American people suffer until you change your ways, that would be interpreted as an act of war, and the United States would feel it legitimate to respond with any force necessary.
Well, just to take that one step further, as a matter of fact, the U.S. demanded that Europe cut off all supplies, purchase of all Iranian oil. And Europe said we need 6 months in order to do this and arrange other suppliers and so on. And when Iran threatened to cut them off right away, rather than in 6 months, right away there was a howl of outrage. How dare you do that?
Right, because
we can cut you off at any time, but if you stop shipping, this is a terrible crime. That's a double standard times 10.
Oh, yes, double standard. But the fact is, this has become so heavily normalized now. It was just yesterday, actually, I read an article by Matt Taibbi, and he was suggesting that the double standard has become so entrenched now in that the U.S. is full of people that talk about attacking Iran, Syria, and other countries. We know who those people are, members of the Republican Party, members of the U.S. government, prominent media figures. They talk routinely about bombing and doing other things to other people's countries. But if anyone in those targeted countries speaks out and talks about defending themselves, actions they might take in response, then that country is painted as a threat and the people are portrayed as a bunch of crazies. So now it's okay in the view of the United States to swagger all around the world and threaten country A, country B, and country C, but they're not allowed to even talk about the idea of self-defense.
That's exactly right. Or, right, the protection of the very concept of sovereignty today. The U.S. is using its drones all over the world. Now, that's an affront to the sovereignty of any country, and yet it's considered absolutely standard operating procedure. There's all sorts of basing and leasing agreements imposed on countries around the world. Again, an attack on the sovereignty of so many countries where they have no say in this, and yet any resistance to this is described as terror.
Mm-hmm.
And these drones aren't just photographing, they're firing missiles, hellfire missiles. Whole villages, what's going on today in whether it's Yemen or Pakistan, Sudan, Somalia, you'll see two lines maybe in the New York Times, and that's about the extent of coverage of what is an act of war on a country that the U.S. is not at war with.
Well, they have drones over Syria now, too, don't they?
That's right. That's right.
They said they're doing it to pressure or encourage the Syrians to act in a certain way.
Well, it also is feeding, as has just been revealed in terms of how the drones operated in Libya, the drones in Syria, that information is fed directly to sabotage assassination teams, to mercenary units who are going into Syria from Turkey, from Israel, from Iraq, really on every side. Syria is very much besieged, and its borders are being breached by quite an assortment of forces with the support of the U.S. Now, there's a political opposition in Syria, but that's entirely different from what is happening in terms of the explosions, the assassinations of officials and all of that.
Well, NATO and those Gulf Cooperation Council states, they can't keep their hands off anyone's rebellion or anyone's uprising or anyone's opposition. In Bahrain, of course, Saudi Arabia was very fast to send in tanks to repress an uprising there. And when there's other kinds of activities in other countries, we always manage to get ourselves involved. The parallel between Libya and Syria is very clear, and we know that at the earlier stages of the armed actions in Libya, there were already UK special forces on the ground, and there was ships on the way, and so forth. In the case of Syria, I imagine similar preparations are now underfoot.
It's important you raise both the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Arab League because again and again they're referred to in the media and by political officialdom in Washington as if this is a representative voice of the Arab people. So who are they? These are the corrupt, feudal dictatorships, monarchies, absolute monarchies that exist in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in Qatar, in Bahrain, in the United Arab Emirates, Oman, and that's who makes up both the Gulf, the Cooperation Council, and also has been the voice of the Arab League. The Arab League, then you include the monarchies in Morocco, in Jordan, and so on. But every one of them, dictatorships, no elected government whatsoever, figurehead appointed parliaments, and yet they become the voice demanding regime change in Syria.
Now, you had mentioned the difficulty of talking about Libya when NATO was directly attacking Libya. People did not want to discuss that. Often on the left or the anti-war movement, it wasn't being addressed nearly as much. And I was reading Monthly Review Zine, and someone commented on Twitter that it seems when NATO and those GCC states get together on an issue, it's almost like instant hegemony. No one challenges it. No one in the media challenges it. The governments are on side. And a lot of the opposition among activists just dissipates. So you can't talk about it. And it seems in the case of Libya and now Syria, what you have is the media just throws all sorts of stuff out there about what is happening in Syria, according to them. It's like they're sending out all sorts of bullets and artillery shells, and everyone in the activist movements often just want to get away from that, dive for cover, and not have to face that onslaught.
Very, very true. See, the GCC, as I say, this is really Washington's creation. Who props up every one of these completely unrepresentative dictatorships? Who keeps these feudal monarchies in office, in power, to this day? And that is the arms from Washington. And not only the arms, the security apparatus that just shoots on sight anyone who's protesting. And what's happened to the movement in Bahrain, the clearest example of this, of a completely nonviolent passive resistance movement that gathers in mass rallies and has been shot down again and again, using Saudi forces who simply came into Bahrain, said it was an action of the Gulf Council, a total invasion by any standard, to be used against the population there. So all of this is totally unrepresentative. The giving endless support and credibility and credence to the Arab League as if this were an independent voice, when, as I say, it's, again, representative of the monarchies of the region.
Yes.
Now aggressively speaking out against any force where they see a possibility of upending and changing policy. Syria, with all of its problems, and there's no perfect state, we're not talking about a revolutionary council here, but Syria has provided for decades important aid and assistance to the Palestinians, to the struggle in Lebanon, in ways that the resistance in the region would not have been possible without. And those who want to undermine Syria and impose regime change, that's really what they want to change. That's what they want to change. It's not that Syria stopped trade, stopped investment, did any of those things. Well, but they see an opportunity to have a complete U.S.-NATO creation in the region.
Ask yourself, what happened in the case of Libya? There are a lot of promises made about Libya and how it would lead to democracy, it would lead to change all over Africa, all over the Middle East, and now Libya is a complete wreck, and it seems it's worse in every way than it was before. So why would anyone be optimistic about violent regime change, foreign intervention in Syria, instead of just leaving it up to the Syrians?
Exactly. No, this is so true. Really, it's to see the ruin of Libya today and to see cities with no functioning infrastructure, to know that NATO deliberately targeted the water, and the electric grid. In modern cities where you have the majority of the population living in apartment blocks, if you have no functioning elevator, if you have no plumbing, life becomes hell. And
it destroys the political discourse in that country. It doesn't lead people to say, I can have a better life now that my country's been bombed and my government is gone. Now they're struggling for scraps. There's militias fighting each other and instability in the country. So it diminishes the political discourse in that country. It lowers the level of what's possible.
Yes, it absolutely does. And it's why it is a responsibility, an obligation to both speak out, organize, mobilize against these policies, and also do everything we can to attack the credibility of those who speak so grandly as if they're representing human rights or democracy in any of these countries they're wrecking havoc with.
Yes, and you can't get straight talk on any of these issues. The level of learned ignorance in the United States and Canada is astonishing on the simplest of issues. I just saw a Facebook discussion in which some people were arguing for Iran to let the inspectors in, nuclear inspectors. They've been there for years.
Exactly. The
program's been monitored.
Exactly.
So we can't get the simplest facts about Iran, facts which are known and verifiable, disappear when we start talking about war.
Right. And actually, if you asked anyone really in the U.S., and I'm sure this is true in Canada today, who has nuclear weapons in the Middle East, they would tell you Iran. That would be stated as an absolute fact by the average person on the street, and it's because consciously the media has distorted the question.
It's like those opinion polls that took place a few years after the war with Iraq, in which Americans, a good chunk of Americans, believed that Iraq was tied to Al-Qaeda and 9/11, even though that was never demonstrated. Well, I know we've got to get...
I just wanted to say one point on this, because I think this is important to recognize that U.S. imperialism and NATO, the European powers, are not all-powerful. And we could look back to 8 and 10 years ago when they seemed unstoppable. No one could possibly, in a country as ruined as Iraq was, already ground down, or a country without any infrastructure, such as Afghanistan was, it seemed could possibly resist U.S. domination. And yet, they utterly failed in Iraq and were forced to withdraw. And it's a much greater catastrophe that they're now facing in Afghanistan. So as grim as it looks, we also need to know that they cannot impose their rule. They can lay waste the countries. But it has not at this point, and this is a problem for U.S. empire in this age, that in previous times, a war anywhere, even the first steps of this, would suffice for complete domination. And that's no longer true today. There are powerful movements, even among people who've been dislocated by war, that refuse. And we can certainly see that in Iraq and Afghanistan. We can also see the first sprouts of that happening in Libya. And that is the challenge we need to also be aware of.
Yes,
they can't do it. They did in earlier ages, and also this vast spending for militarism no longer saves or bails out their economy. So this is something for us really to take note of, and to make it part of our measurement, too, of these wars.
No, there's no benefit for most Americans going to war like that. And you're talking about alternatives to the present situation here. And although we're almost out of time, it's something to think about here. The anti-war movement seems to be coming back in the United States and in Canada. And we're in a slightly different political climate than we were, say, 8 years ago. You've talked about the economic issues. Anti-war activists in the United States have talked about the cost of war, both in human lives and in material, in money. And we know the cost is very high. And with movements like Occupy now, it looks like there's greater economic dimension, greater talk of class, and the ultimate impacts on the U.S. economy, on American lives, when these wars are continued and pursued, including an expanding security state. So do you think that upcoming protests are going to be fused more with discussions of the economic consequences of these kind of actions?
Absolutely, because it is a different world than it was even just a few years ago. The economic problems are unsolvable. the this crisis, this really this capitalist crisis, has ground on and on. The sheer rate of unemployment and youth facing a future with no jobs, being continually downskilled and having lower and lower wage scales, no hope of having the standard of living that their parents or past generations had. All of this changes, and it rings true that these wars are profitable for the 1% and disastrous for the rest of the population here, that the wars come home, and they come home in terrible ways. This now, it actually rings true, and it's why the average person is against the wars. They know that they pay for it, and yet they're in a worse situation for it.
Well, the sending
so
of drones,
we want to use that constantly, and it's a real contribution of the Occupy movement.
I think so. I mean, the bombing, destruction of buildings all over the world, use of all these advanced weapons is not unconnected to the deployment of spy apparatus on American citizens, the use of drones in American cities. It's not two separate issues, and I think people are increasingly realizing that.
Right. Wow. So that is the war at home. And it's intensifying. It's really the measures that are being used as standard operating procedure. But it means that the people waking up find they have new identification with struggles that previously they would not have thought about.
Yes. Well, thanks. We're going to take this back. We're going to be having anti-war actions coming up. And, of course, you are coming to Toronto this Saturday, actually. And although we've got our own teach-ins in the planning stages here in Hamilton locally, I encourage people to go out to the Toronto Toronto teach-in. I'm going to have information about that coming right up after this interview. So, Sarah, thanks very much. We look forward, for some of us, seeing you on the upcoming Saturday. It looks like it's going to be a great event, and finally people are talking in a big way about these issues.
Thank you so much.